So thanks for being a good sport.
My pleasure.
Emily is here with me today because I need to sign some pages and we need to record an episode of the podcast. And Dan is having a mental health day and we wish him the best and feeling better. And so Emily's going to fill in. And we are still in our personas from our live stream.
Yeah, I think we need to explain why we look this crazy.
Why do we look this crazy?
We did a live stream.
Mm-hmm.
Our alter egos, B-Money and E-Money, from mm-hmm. the last crowdfunding campaign have now altered to become B-Swift and E-Swifty.
Yep.
So.
Yep. So we've moved into a new era.
A new era.
Of our...
What did you call it? Nerd Hop was
Nerd
the first
Hop
one?
Was our first
and
one.
And now we're now it's we're our glitter
our
era.
Glitter era, yeah. Of being powerful music influencers who don't make music.
Right.
Yes. That is what we are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, be
so
money.
I don't normally look like this.
Yeah. And we thought we would talk about the origins of Dragonsteel, our company.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are very interested about that. Like, how do a couple of English nerds end up starting a giant media company? Because it's kind of giant now.
It is kind of giant.
At least for us.
For
us.
We have
between 50 and 60 employees.
Yeah,
which is,
I think we have 54 on payroll right now.
Yeah. Which is not giant as
for commercial,
yeah.
you know, business.
It's not like, you know, we are the size of Google, but... Mm.
I hope we never get to the size of Google.
But we are, you know, bigger than any other author company, I think, in the world. I think we're most likely bigger than even Pottermore and people, though we don't know for sure.
Yeah. It is hard to know.
It's hard to know.
But I haven't found anybody else that I can talk to mm-hmm. because they're all like, I've never heard of all of that kind of stuff that you're doing. So
yeah, we sit with our writer friends and they'll be like, what?
Yeah.
Why would you even do this?
Which is a good question. Why do we do this?
Why do we even do this?
Do we want to talk about that first or we want to talk about like
I guess we
chronologically?
Can talk about chronologically.
I think the reasons have changed
mm-hmm.
why we do this.
Yeah.
But I remember when you first said, you know, I want to form a company. I want to, you know, create an LLC. And I was like, why? You know, it's just you and me. You know, you write books. And at that point, I don't think I was even helping with fan mail yet. I was just... Yeah.
Suffering me putting books in the garage.
Yeah.
And reading early drafts.
Yeah, reading early drafts. But Brandon was like, no, my agent says that, you know, you need to form an LLC and...
So at that point, the only reason we started the LLC was because it does limit your liability,
mm-hmm.
which means that if someone were to come after the books with a lawsuit for whatever reason, they could only take the money... that the books earn, theoretically.
Not everything.
Yeah. Again, I'm not a lawyer or an accountant, so I don't know 100%, but that's like the purpose of an LLC.
Yeah.
And I had had a teacher at BYU who had written a nonfiction book. And I didn't ever think anything like this would happen to me, but I bet he didn't think it happened to him.
Yeah.
Where he did not properly document the people he'd interviewed.
Sources, yeah.
And like he documented who did it and mm-hmm. he was very clear with where he got his information, but he didn't get the right forms given to them.
Mm-hmm.
So a person he'd interviewed passed away and the person's children said, well, we want to sell his story. And you've now got a competing story because you used his story of his life as part of your book and you didn't have a release form.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sued and won.
Yeah.
And that's always terrified me a little bit. Number one, make sure that you have your documentation yeah. all in line. But I write fantasy. I'm not doing what he did. He wrote historical fiction where he would mm-hmm. use real people's life stories. You know, I know he just thought, well, this is public record. This
yeah.
is great.
I got it from the source. And
but it was only because the children wanted a competing story and then said, well, it's already on the market.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, having yeah. a limited liability company seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. At first, I was kind of like, okay, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I could see the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of Brandon's friends who was a lawyer come over to our house, our little town home in Provo, and bring all the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those memories I've talked about before, but it's kind of burned in my memory because I was hugely pregnant with Joel because it was September and he was born in October. And I remember leaning over my huge pregnant belly to sign the paperwork. It's just one of those things. It was kind of fun. I kind of felt like, hey, we're all grown up. We're making a company.
Now, before that, I think before, I had bought my Remainders, which was our first kind of entrepreneurial step.
Yeah, you had already bought Remainders by then.
For those who don't know, publishers overprint on purpose because basically you want to always have a book on the shelf when someone goes to find it, particularly back in the days before Amazon kind of taking over. Mm-hmm. Someone went to the bookstore to get your book, you want them to find it. So they'd rather have one extra book there that gets on the shelf that never sells than one too few. And so they always had an overage back then. Less so now because they print fewer physical books, but they always had an overage. And at the end, they would sell them to discounting places. They go in the front of Barnes & Noble's for $3, or they would go to where...
There's some deep discount warehouses, and I don't know...
What do you call those? Like the things at Traverse Mountain, the types of stores.
Outlets?
Outlet stores. Yeah, there would be book outlet stores and things where you could get these books. You can tell if it's one of these. It has a black dot. Usually somewhere on the...
Usually on the closed pages on the top or the bottom.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they still do it the same way, but it was always just a Sharpie black dot.
It's like, this has been a remainder, which means the bookstore sent it back unsold. They marked it and then sold it at a discount. And I heard that they did this and that they sold them to the deep discounting stores for $1 a piece.
Yeah.
And these are $25 hardcovers. And I'm like... Well, I want to be able to sell these books. I want to have copies when I go to book signings and the bookstore doesn't have any. I want to have the hardcovers when the paperback's out for sale. And so I bought them all 2,000 of them for $1 each back when 2,000 was a lot of money for us to spend on something like that. And that was Brandon's first entrepreneurial moment. Buy those, sell them on my website.
Well, and sell them signed was the thing.
Sell them signed. Yep. Personalized and signed for birthdays and things like that.
And, you know, at first it was like... maybe 2-3 copies a week.
Or a month.
Or a month. Yeah. But we had our one car garage and it was completely full of boxes of books. So we couldn't park in it. But we used those books. Actually, I needed a place to put the birdcage that was out of reach of our toddler. And so I stacked up a bunch of boxes of books and put a sheet over them and put the birdcage on it. So it made it a very nice side table.
We had those boxes for a long while.
We did.
Yep. But we did eventually sell every one of them at $1 plus shipping, turning into $25.
Which is pretty good margins.
Back when we were earning $5,000 a year off of our writing, that was a help.
Yeah, and we had, I don't know if I ever shipped any of them. I think we hired Becky to do that right away.
Becky was shipping for us right away.
So she would come and pick up the three books that had been signed and, you know, take them to the post office and send them to the person. And then it just, as you got more popular, it got bigger and bigger.
And we had to start ordering directly from the publisher at a 50% discount rather than super steep discount because they stopped having remainders because my hardcovers sell.
Yeah.
And the publishers learned that they sell. And in fact, like the Stormlight Archive hardcovers are constantly being reprinted. So that they get the remainders, they don't send them to the discounters because they hold on to them because people want the hardcovers and they order them. And Amazon helps with that, right? Yep. Like as much as I worry about Amazon's dominance of the market, it lets you be able to get hardcovers when you want them.
Yeah.
They'll keep them in stock as long as they're selling.
I must admit I've taken advantage of that a time or two.
So we no longer have the remainders, but what did you think when I first tried to hire an assistant?
I was... very glad. I thought that was a good idea. And I remember we were at Kevin J. Anderson's place for a kind of a writing retreat.
Yeah, powwow, business powwow with Kevin and Eric and Dave.
And they were the ones that said, you really need an assistant. And you had thought of Peter. And I think you just went and called him right then.
I did, that night. I said, I need an assistant. I think I can give you 20 hours a week.
Yeah.
Is that enough? And lo and behold...
he was going to do freelance editing for the rest of the time. And we thought, yeah, only 20 hours a week. But it didn't stay that way for very long.
It was like a month before he was 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
And there was no time for freelancing. And back then, he just did all the assistant duties.
Yeah.
And that's about as far as most authors go. Because we had somebody doing our mail and stuff. Yep. That was Becky. And we had an assistant to kind of help with things and whatnot. And the vast majority of authors, that's where it ends. But, you know, I started to see what this could be at that point.
Did you?
Not where it, like, there's been phases, right?
Yeah.
But the first phase was saying, I don't want to be beholden to the publisher for a lot of the things that they are providing because I'm even as their best-selling author, I could see that just things didn't always work. When a publicist has 300 people that they have to publicize, they don't ever have that many, but 50 people they need to publicize, things tend to not get done. Mm-hmm. And when...
Well, and that was one of the things we kind of took on pretty quickly because... You know, they don't send new authors on tour very often. And you kind of volunteered to go on tour and, you know, made the arrangements and figured it out. And for a while, I did that, you know, kind of helping to make sure that you had things set up and bookstores to go to. And
when you have a good publicist, it all works. But sometimes you get one that's, you know, less focused on you. And then we'd have bad tours. And so Emily started taking over that. And that might be like one of the first big things you did was taking over the tours, like setting them up. And you by then having to do the finances because we'd hired somebody, but then, because I did them our first few years. But then we hired a person to do them and we needed a liaison who could go talk to the accountant during business hours, which are not something
not
that's
hours
really,
when you are awake.
And you just kind of started taking over the finances at that point, like the taxes and everything.
Which was kind of hard for me because I am not a finance person. I'm not a numbers person. I was like, if the accountant will tell me what to do, then I can do this.
And that got really complicated really fast. I still feel bad about, I'm glad we finally got that off of your plate mostly because.
I was very glad when Kara took over that because.
But a good like 10, 15 years, you were doing all of that and. It's
But so you forgot about the brief stint when I was answering fan mail for you. Do you remember that?
You talk about it. I don't actually remember this
remember
one
it?
As well as you do.
You were like, well, you know, I'm getting more fan mail. I need to have time to write kind of thing. And so I said, well, I'll answer some things for you. You tell me what to say.
Yeah, I give you templates.
You give me some templates.
And then kick to me the ones that don't fit a template.
Yeah. And I would write a response and send it to you. And this, I remember this because I had had Joel. And I was dealing with postpartum depression, even though I didn't really know what that was. So I had kind of a hard time because anytime somebody would say something the least bit critical, then I would be all up in arms and write them a really terse response. And you were like, you're not nice enough. And so I think, was that when we hired Rachel and Jeff?
Rachel,
or was that,
so Rachel
or maybe
and
you
Jeff.
Took it back for a while.
No, I think we hired Rachel and Jeff. At that point.
And they weren't employees. We just did it kind of as 1099 contractors. But
And so, we kind of had this like chaotic, not quite a company back then. Because Peter was working for us, but Isaac was a freelancer doing our art.
Yes.
And we had an accountant, but you were doing most of that work.
I was doing the bookkeeping.
And we had someone helping with the fan mail, but they were just our brother and sister-in-law who were getting...
We paid them, but they weren't employees.
And I think the big next revolution is when we went to hire Kara, where we realized we needed someone to handle shipping and things. It's kind of funny because we needed somebody to do my assistant duty because Peter had moved full into just doing all editorial work.
Yeah.
He couldn't do like the assistant stuff. And it was overwhelming you to try to do my scheduling because you had all the financial stuff. And we also had the shipping, which was growing bigger than Becky's.
Yeah, I remember those last years before she passed it off to Kara that she would come and, you know, fill up her car with books to send. And it was causing problems for her with her little family.
And so we're like, we need a person for this. Again, we said we need a person maybe 20 hours a week to partially assist in and partially do this. And so we went to Kara.
Well, because Kara and Isaac had started Inkwing.
Yes.
They
that's true.
I think they were paying us royalties, but they used the art that Isaac had done for us and created merch. You know, they had t-shirts and I think t-shirts and like lanyards, I think was it. But, you know, Kara being Kara, she set it all up with the store app and had
Yeah, she
everything.
Was our first merch doing it as we licensed to her because we just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
And so.
And then we talked about bringing her on to do it. We're like, well, you're selling merch and we're selling books. What if we just put them all together?
Yeah. What if we bought Inkwing, basically? It's like, what if we did this in-house instead? Yeah. Which has kind of turned into our mantra. What if we did this in-house?
Well, that's kind of been our business model is what can we get someone else to do so that Brandon doesn't have to do it and Brandon can write? And now it's kind of become, can we get someone else to do that Emily doesn't have to do?
But we were in our new house.
Yes.
And we were in the basement and we offered a job to Kara and said, we'll buy Inkwing. We'll give you a 20-hour week. And Isaac, who was working at a video game company at the time, I still remember he looked, he's like, I want a job like that. I don't want to work at my video game company anymore. And I'm like, oh, Isaac, we could
use an artist.
We could use an artist. And we talked it through with them and we decided we'd hire them both at halftime.
Yeah.
Kind of as one full salaried employee. Because mm-hmm. by then, Peter was full salaried. Mm-hmm. So Kara was our second employee and Isaac our third. Mm-hmm. But together they were one full-time employee.
Yeah, because they had young kids at the time and they mm-hmm. worked it out so they could each work, you know, half the time.
Yeah, that was the theory.
That was the theory. I don't know that it ever happened. Eventually, we moved them to three quarters,
yeah,
both of them. But if you know Isaac and Kara, you know that
yep.
you know, they were working way beyond
yeah.
the hours that they were allotted pretty soon.
And so we then had an in-house merch and art department mm-hmm. by that point. And Adam was hired within a year because
yes.
I was already thinking I needed an in-house publicist.
Well, and part of it was, too, that everyone started out as your assistant
yeah.
and then moved on to doing other things. And the assistant jobs got dropped and you were like, hey, I need yeah. somebody to do this assistant stuff.
Because we'd hire them for half that and half yeah. something else. So Kara started and quickly moved to Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
Isaac got overwhelmed by it for art. And so I'm like, well, publicist is more of an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of publicists, what they do is author assistant stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I need a publicist. And I went to Adam and I'm like, what do you think about being a publicist and
well,
an assistant?
I think I suggested it to you.
You might have. Yeah, I thought Jane did.
No,
maybe
I
it
did.
Was you. Because Jordo suggested Kathy.
Yes.
But you suggested Adam.
Yep.
Yeah. And so we went to him, and what we did was we sent him to New York for a year to intern at mm-hmm. Tor to learn publicity mm-hmm. sort of things. And then he came back and was my assistant slash publicist.
Yeah.
And he lasted the longest as an assistant mm-hmm. until we got real assistants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like era two is where it's like we made a real company, but it's basically a real small publishing house
mm-hmm.
to do all the things that Brandon needs, like take over publicity from Tor so that we have an in-house publicity, take over art directing from Tor so that we have control over art, and take over editorial and then a small merchandise store mm-hmm. run by one person.
Yeah.
That's when I realized we could do the leather bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, we have the artists, we have the shipping, we have all the stuff in-house, we could start working on Leatherbounds. And I pitched that, and that kind of is what started to really fuel Dragonsteel.
Yeah.
Like, I've told this story before, but Tor sold 250 copies of the Wheel of Time books at $250 also.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, where mm-hmm. inflation-wise, it's more like 500, 600 bucks,
mm-hmm.
probably. I don't know. You'd have to run the actual inflation. But it was more than 250.
Yes.
This was 30 years ago. And they're like, we just can't make any money on these. I'm like, I think in the modern era, people want these. You're charging too much for them.
Mm-hmm.
You aren't letting them know. You don't have enough of them, and you aren't letting people know how they can get them. So people would buy those copies, but they don't know how to get a hold of them because
mm-hmm.
a bookstore might have one. There's 3,000 just Borders and Barnes & Nobles in the country if you combine them together. Mm-hmm. And 250 copies, who knows who will have one
yeah.
and how you order one. And I heard that frustration from fans trying to get mm-hmm. hold of them. And so I got the rights back. Tom Gordy gave them to me for free. Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took that. And then we sold 10,000 mm-hmm. at $100. And these are expensive. Part of the reason why is the margins are not great on Leatherbounds,
mm-hmm.
but the margins are good enough that 10,000 is like a real company income mm-hmm. suddenly. Just kind of out of nowhere, we had real, like an actual, not an actual company yet, but an actual income like a company
yeah.
should have.
And it was interesting too. I think part of the reason we were able to do that mm-hmm. is that you had cultivated a fan base, you know?
Yeah.
And remember your blog post that you where you would do like the weird pictures kind of things?
Don't bring those up. Those are so bad. Old puns. I like puns. Just let me tell you, I like puns. And I would Photoshop a pun and see if people could guess what the pun was.
Uh-huh. It was pretty awesome.
But it was not awesome. They were terrible.
I liked them.
Mm.
But it was a way to, what you said was, I got to have content. You know, I got to have something on my website for people to
not just
come
that,
and see.
Like, I wanted to have a resource. I wanted to actually be providing value add
mm-hmm.
so that where people were coming, like, this is why I started writing excuses.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I even podcast now, in part, is so that, like, and why I did all this work, why I teach the class. I'm like, I want there to be things for people that I'm adding to the community,
mm-hmm.
not just always asking them for money.
Yeah.
And
writing excuses was getting pretty, I mean, it started when we were in our Provo house.
Yeah. It was getting pretty big by then.
It was getting pretty big by then.
Yep.
And I actually was doing the bookkeeping for that too.
Yeah, you got the raw deal on that one. You kind of got roped into doing bookkeeping for even the podcast. But that era lasted for a while.
Yep.
Like Kara started to hire people to help her with shipping.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought on Ben McSweeney as a contractor because he's the person who did all the concept art for Way of Kings back in 2009.
Yep.
Just as a freelancer. And then I'd hired with Isaac to start doing like Shalon sketchbook pages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would count as our next employee, even though he was contracting. Mm-hmm. We would have hired him as an employee, but he was remote and he was in Canada. And things
but
like that.
But he was working, I think he was only doing our stuff right then.
Yeah, by then he was only doing stuff. So if we count Peter, then Kara, then Isaac, then Adam, it's number five was Ben. Mm-hmm. Though, like the rest of them, he'd done work from us.
Yeah.
You know, way starting out.
Mm-hmm. Well, he started as doing fan art.
Fan art, and then I hired him for the concept art. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 2009, like I said, like the first things of Way of Kings that I showed to anyone were Ben's concept arts of the characters. And so that kind of pushed to the point that that was still a family small business, right? Family business.
And it was all out of our house.
All out of our house. And it started to hit the breaking point at that point where we had to make that tough transition. We either had to say, this is it, we're stopping, or we had to make the tough transition into like real actual media company.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hard like 5 years of growth.
It was. And it, partly because I don't, well, we didn't know what we were doing. You know, a lot of times you think of someone, if they are creating a business, they have a business plan and they, you know, I don't know. It seems like there are a lot of businesses that do it the way we did, where it's organic and you do it by the seat of your pants. But I kind of felt like we didn't really know what we were doing.
Yeah. I did know what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Right? Like as soon as the first Leatherbound sold, I had a vision. I'm like, all right. And the main reason for this, and I've been building to this for years with putting our people in house and things like that. The main reason is I wanted to future-proof being able to write books. And we are still in the middle of this. I don't know where it'll go. But we had back then, I think it was 2014, was a big scare. This is when the publishers and Amazon went to war.
Yep.
And Amazon turned off the ability to buy my books and all books from Macmillan on Amazon for a month. Just no one could buy the books. And by then, they were already the biggest 70% of the market or something like that. So them turning off my books, as I wrote it back then on a blog post, it wasn't that big a deal for me. People waited a month, bought my stuff. But the new authors who released that month, all of them crashed and burned.
Them.
And I realized someone having that much power over not just me, but all of these people I'd hired, that legitimately frightened me. And I thought, I need a way to build a company so that if Tor goes out of business, because I had seen companies go out of business and their authors never recover because the relationships they'd built at the company were the editors who really advocated for their work. And as soon as that advocate left, the book stopped selling because there wasn't an editor to catch the vision and share it with
we
everyone.
We had a little bit of that, you know, with
Alcatraz.
They call it getting orphaned. You know, your editor leaves and then the person that they hand your book to didn't buy it and doesn't really care so much about it. And
yeah, Alcatraz, the publisher loved until my editor left right before the first book came out and then nothing.
Yeah.
And like these experiences taught me, I either need to just kind of be like a normal author, go with the flow, float on what happens and take it if it comes. And I was hearing some big name authors that I knew who couldn't sell books anymore for some of these reasons.
Yeah.
Or I needed to build something that I had the power and control over so that if the publisher went out of business, it didn't matter. If Amazon turned us off again, I had another way to sell my books and my fans were used to being able to get them that way. And that is what made me make the decision to jump to the next level was that if I didn't do that, I would never have, like you become a writer to have control over your destiny, right? To not, you know, to not be the person who's always wondering, am I going to get fired?
You always talk about the phantom cubicle.
The phantom cubicle chasing me. And I realized until I had the company, until I was in control of that, we can't control like how the market will change.
Yeah, the market.
People might stop liking my books. Hopefully I can write good enough ones that won't happen. But sometimes, you know, we can't control that. But what we can control is if we're in charge of the books. And so that's when I said, I think, you know, we need to take that next step.
Mm-hmm.
And like that was a big deal because that was a growth from kind of like 5 to 8 employees, if you count kind of some assistant stuff, to 50 employees. And we did that across, and that was hard.
Yeah.
That was the hard part. What was hard about that?
Partly it was not knowing what questions to ask. There are a lot of things when you're a company, there's, you know, and you have payroll and you have payroll taxes and you have workers' comp and you have all of these other things that nobody tells you you need to set up or how to set them up. And we had a couple of things where, out of ignorance, we made some mistakes and had to pay for them.
Yeah.
But the thing that was helpful was I kind of made it my philosophy to, okay, I don't know how to do this. Find somebody who does and ask lots of questions. And that's been the really helpful thing is try and find somebody who's an expert in their field and let them do it or, you know, get their help. Because for me, that was, it was pretty terrifying to think of if we crash and burn, you know, our dear friends and family also crash and burn. You know, Brandon's crazy ideas are supporting how many families now?
But we became, that's when we became a real company, mostly because of you. Like I said, let's do this, but you're the one that like made an HR department and right, like made payroll happen. And
by then it was fun to me, you know, like I think that I always did part-time in the business. I think I would have, if we hadn't made a company, I would have had to go back to teaching or something because just being at home all day, all
the
time.
Once the kids get old and go to school, it's like, all right, we've done the parenting duty. Now what?
Well, and parenting older kids is even harder. But yeah, it's, I needed something else to be part of my
identity.
You considered
going back to school for
a while.
I did.
The other thing about it was fun to work with you, you know, because writing is so much a part of who you are and your passion and your all of that. I think that I think about some women who send their husband off to work and they're like, goodbye, dear, have a nice day. And then they see him back in the evening and they don't really even know what their husband does or what his job is or anything. And that wouldn't have worked for us.
Mm-hmm.
I love the behind the scenes of things and I like to know how they work. And I really enjoy being nosy and being in in charge of everything from the behind the scenes. So, and it's satisfying to me to have our dear friends and family, you know, have a job where they can use their talents and they can, you know, all together create something really awesome. So,
and that's the point where we actually started hiring people we didn't know.
Yes.
We started actually doing what a real company is supposed to and put out, you know, like
job offers.
Yeah, job, not offers, what do you call them? Job postings. Thank you. Job postings and things like this. And this culminated in the big Kickstarter that I knew was coming and the rest of you didn't.
That's kind of a theme.
Yeah.
Brandon has to think 5 years beyond the rest of us.
Yeah.
And if he shares his ideas too quickly, we all get scared.
Yes.
So he kind of has to wait until it's the right time. And then everyone, you know, he, when Brandon shares an idea, you can't help but get excited about it.
And I knew like the secret projects was my main plan to future-proof the company, to be able to sell first-run books directly to my fans. And I knew it was coming. I didn't know it would be as big as it was. I knew it was coming.
Well, and you had several experiments you were doing with that, which is maybe part of the thing that's terrifying to me is, you know, I'm not just going to try out one thing. I'm going to try out 5 new things all at once.
But that culminated in that. And the big change we made right then is that we then made like actual official departments. And we took Isaac and made him VP over editorial. We did Kara over merchandise and events and Isaac over what we call creative development, art and concept art and kind of film stuff, and Adam over publicity and marketing. And then
and all of those departments have kind of evolved a little bit since we started them. The other thing we did is we bought the house next door to ours and moved everybody over there.
Yep. and then eventually bought a warehouse and
leased a warehouse. Leased it in, outgrew that in about a year because of the Kickstarter, and had to lease a bigger place
that we turned into office space so that people aren't working next door to us anymore.
Yeah.
And so the final touches on that happen like in June, and finally everybody will be in like one place that's not our next door house.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I didn't mention Matt. I want to mention Matt just in case he happens to watch, because Matt Hatch we hired over operations in HR and then made him a VP kind of straight into it. And then Dan into narrative was kind of the final touch we needed there.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how it continues to evolve, because that's one thing I've learned is that nothing stays the same.
Nope. I'm planning for the 5 years. I've warned you about some of these
things. Oh, yes. I'm trying not to be terrified.
She's trying not to be terrified. We'll see. It'll always happen. Some of this depends on other people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the story of Dragonsteel. It's how it started as two English majors who were sitting in their kitchen in a 1,200 square foot townhome that we stuffed Peter into the unfinished basement to work into having like a giant warehouse and 54 employees and like being grown-ups with like a real company.
Every once in a while, I still feel like, wait, we're in charge of this thing? Where are the grown-ups? Why are we doing this? We are the grown-ups. That's kind of the terrifying thing.
How's that, Dan?